Please be seated. Good morning to you all, and welcome to the first argument of the 2018-2019 term. It's a rainy day outside, but we have had some good briefs, and we look forward to some very good arguments today on the cases that are set. Well, my notes are the usual ones. You've divided the time, as you generally do. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Yeah, please. Yes. Yes. I want to let everybody know that Justice Abrahamson is on the phone. I haven't talked to her, but our marshal tells me that she is. So, though we have an empty chair, she's apparently may ask questions, but at least can listen. So, if you will begin, please.
Good morning. My name is Edward Hunt.
Edward Hunt.
I represent Gary L. Wierski, the petitioner before this court. Mr. Wierski was found guilty by a jury of 8 counts of sexual assault of a child by a person who works or volunteers with children, 2 counts of child enticement, 2 counts of exposing genitals or pubic area, 2 counts of exposing a child to harmful materials, and 2 counts of causing a child older than 13 to view or listen to sexual activity, 2 counts. It is in the twilight, the last few important minutes of this trial, that a disaster occurred that I submit to this court must be rectified. To be more precise, this was a criminal case, but it was a criminal case that was different than other cases.
Counsel, was the disaster that he was not asked whether he admitted to the crime to the informant? Is that what the disaster was?
That was one of the disasters, Judge.
All right, so let's concentrate on that one for just a moment. Okay. My understanding is that Mr. Wierski maintained throughout the trial the JP and JH had fabricated the incident, correct?
You are correct.
And he denied having committed those crimes?
Yes.
Okay. So doesn't that necessarily imply that he did not admit the crimes to Mr. Clark?
Pardon me, sir?
Doesn't that necessarily imply that he did not admit to the crimes to Mr. Clark? Because what we're trying to figure out is, was there really a problem with the failure to ask whether he had admitted these crimes to Mr. Clark, right? That's what we're after here.
Yes.
Okay. So if he has maintained throughout the trial that he did not commit the crimes, what additional mileage do you get out of having him deny that he admitted this to Mr. Clark?
Because, Your Honor, the state of Wisconsin thought it was important enough to bring in someone from a jail with a confession. And confessions are different. Confessions must be rebutted. And this confession came at rebuttal. Now, the trial court allowed surrebuttal, and there was only one purpose of that surrebuttal. Since Clark testified that the defendant admitted to him that he had masturbated these juveniles and allowed them to watch pornography, it was incumbent to ask a very simple question. Did you confess to Mr. Clark, Mr. Wierski? Did you confess that you had sexually assaulted, masturbated these young men?
Yeah, we got the picture there. So if the jury obviously did not believe him when he denied having done this, correct?
Did not believe Mr. Wierski?
Correct.
They
convicted him, right?
He got convicted.
Okay, so obviously they didn't believe him when he said, I didn't do this.
What I think they did believe, Your Honor, is Clark, because there was no answer to that
Counsel, there was semen that he collected that was of one of the boys that was evidence in this trial. How can you go on and on about a confession he made or didn't make when you have that kind of evidence?
Well, because
as well as the testimony of both boys.
Right. Part of the theory of defense here was that the defendant was set up. Those boys could have set him up. One of them could have placed his ejaculate on that dish. What I find really remarkable is this, Your Honor. We have here a police officer and two juvenile delinquents that they had theft accusations against them and that they were either under some type of informal or court supervision. Come on. A guy who's a chief of police of a northern Wisconsin county and also a police officer, the northern Wisconsin, not county, northern Wisconsin town is Wheeler, he's a police officer and also in Boysville, he's going to leave out a plate like that? That seems to me really hard to believe.
Well, his conduct perhaps was a little bit hard to believe too, Counselor.
And when you say conduct, you're talking about the evidence that was seized from the computer?
It's not the usual thing, obviously, for adult men to behave that way with juvenile boys, and we have laws that restrict it. So, you know, to say that he was a police officer so he never would have done it, well.
Well, but think about it. Day in and day out in courtrooms, we have police officers that step up, they testify, and they give an account of a series of events. And then there are, in those same types of trials, people that have trouble with the law get up there and we accept the police version. We're inclined to do that.
Okay, but in this case, the question is whom to believe. So Mr. Wierski testified, swore that he did not do these things. Mr. Clark says that he admitted to him that he did. So the question is whether you're going to believe Mr. Wierski or Mr. Clark, right? So why would they believe Mr. Wierski if he denied making the confession, if they didn't believe him when he denied doing the act?
Well, Judge, I think they would have believed him denying the confession because that came at the last moments of the trial.
But why?
I think
why,
it was a very powerful. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah. Why would they be inclined to believe the denial of the confession when they were not inclined to believe the denial of the crime?
Well, Judge, we don't know. I mean, what could have been the kill shot for this case for Mr. Wierski is the fact that he gets up there and doesn't deny the confession. That's the last thing that the jury had. Did that poison his other denials? Quite possibly. A jury could have used, well, you know, he got back up there on the stand. The clerk, the jailhouse snitch, only testified to the confession. He's up there on the stand, and he doesn't deny it. It's tantamount to an admission of guilt. That did not occur during Wierski's testimony. That silence, that failure of his trial counsel, and it comes down to a failure of the trial counsel to ask that simple series of questions about, did you confess?
Counsel?
And, yep.
I see the law development issue in this case as a different issue than we are now discussing. In this case, it's advanced that the Court of Appeals changed, either by modifying or overruling, a prior case of Randall. The Court of Appeals arguably stated in this case that the state no longer had to turn over information that it previously would have had to turn over under Randall because of CCAP, that is, our Circuit Court Automation Project. It's readily available. The Court of Appeals said it is no longer referring to the Randall case, an intolerable burden on the defense. Can you address that issue, please?
Thank you. Yes, Judge, they changed the drill completely. They're saying that, well, he could have found it on CCAP. I disagree with the Court of Appeals assessment that, well, that's not an intolerable burden on the defense. The downside of this is It does create an atmosphere for gamesmanship on the part of prosecutors. They can hold off when they're going to file charges against a particular witness, and to place that burden on Wierski's counsel that wasn't placed on him before, they placed it in the Court of Appeals, in the Court of Appeals decision when Brady and Giglio and Kyles, they've always placed burden for impeachment information on the defense. One thing that should be noted here, the prosecutor here didn't think that this pending information was related. In other words, that it didn't have any relevancy. And he had a copy of the criminal complaint. And that wasn't turned over. And as you recall, Mr. Clark's last series of questions... Mr. Clark's last series of questions were directing him... I apologize for that. Last series of questions directed to him were, hey, you getting anything out of this? Nope. No interest in outcome? Nope. Why are you doing it? For the kids. That about says it all, or words to that effect. When it turns out this scoundrel had a bunch of pending charges involving children that, if they'd been disclosed, there would have been great cross-examination.
Counsel, would we, if we agreed with you, would we have to change our conclusion in State versus Amundson, where we said that this court has held that due process is not violated under Brady unless the information in question is within the exclusive possession and control of the authorities?
I don't think you have to change it. I submit that that was in the exclusive possession and control of the prosecution under the state of law at the time that that case was being
tried. It wasn't on CCAP, counsel?
Pardon me?
This information wasn't on CCAP?
I don't know when it was placed on CCAP. I do know I found it on CCAP, and that's why I raised it in my post-conviction motion.
Do you see a distinction, Mr. Hunt, between charges versus a conviction in terms of the information?
Well, no.
And the exclusive control of the state.
Pending charges may be in the exclusive control of the state for this reason. The state has the horses. They have the police reports. They have the witnesses. They know when somebody's being charged. It wasn't like Clark, who was charged a month before the commencement of Wierski's trial. It wasn't like he was charged in Manitoba, Canada. It was the next county over. This case was tried in Dunn, I believe. Clark was charged in Chippewa County.
Counsel, could we concentrate on whether it was in the exclusive possession and control? If it was on CCAP, you would agree that it was not in the exclusive possession and control of the authorities, correct?
Yes, CCAP is not in the exclusive possession and control of the authorities. Anyone can look on CCAP.
Okay, so the question here in this case is, was this information on CCAP?
That I can't answer as to when it was posted, Judge. I'm being frank. I don't know when exactly it was posted. I found it later in the post-conviction process. But if I could go one step further in answering your question.
In one moment. Whose burden is it to establish that it was not in the exclusive possession and control of the authorities?
I think that lies with the state.
Based on what authority?
And based on Brady. They have an obligation, whether they're asked or not, to produce exculpatory and impeaching information.
That's their duty to disclose. The duty to establish whether it was in their exclusive possession and control at the time. Upon whom does that rest?
Well,
I mean, you're making the claim today that something that is admittedly on CCAP may not have been on CCAP at the time. So who has the burden to show whether it was or not?
I don't know whether it was or it wasn't, Judge.
Right. But
I am assuming it was.
Okay.
For purposes of our argument, I'll assume it was.
And Mr. Hunt, let's talk about the access that, when we talk about CCAP, your access versus the state's access. If the attorney had wanted to get a copy of that complaint, would they have been able to do that from CCAP, or would they have had to still go to the courthouse to get a copy of the complaint versus the prosecutor who could have easily accessed it?
That's right down my alley. They would not have been able to get a copy of that complaint off CCAP. They would have to travel to a different county to get that complaint.
And in terms of CCAP access, it depends obviously on internet access, ability to pull up the information, and can you address if this was a pro se defendant, how that access would work?
He'd really be sunk, or she'd be sunk. He or she'd be sunk. If she didn't have internet access, she'd be depending on the good graces of the prosecution, which, if I could just return to Randall for a second, because it ties in. Randall, the argument that the government made, that the state made, was, hey, it's public record. Go find it. Go find what Mr. Williams had pending. You could have found that. Fortunately, the Court of Appeals said, no, we're not going to put a burden on the defendant. Think of this now. Now, think of this. You're getting ready for a major trial. I mean, this was a five-day trial. This was a heavy trial. There was only one defendant, one defense counsel appointed by the public defender's office in this northern county. He's trying to get ready. He's trying to do this. He's trying to do that. And are we expecting him to every other day double-check CCAP? No, that's too much of a burden, especially when they've got the criminal complaint. Just give us the criminal complaint. I don't see what the problem was. Why not let them know?
Randall was just... Counsel, if I agree with you, I'd like you to address whether that error, just say I agree with you for the purposes of the next discussion, whether that error was harmless here.
I don't think it was harmless here.
Why or why? Well, why?
First off, my client was a police officer. He has that credibility that goes with a police officer. Second, my client testified at length and denied every one of the accusations that were being brought against him and explained why these accusations were being brought against him, that he was being set up. Plus, there's four witnesses that were called. Kay Dettard, Kendra Berg, Tiffany Mullins, Alan Meyer, and they all explained that there were various times when Josh Putnam or Hagen had confided that they'd lied or made it up or they were setting up the defendant. There were witnesses that supported the state's case. And I want to commend the Assistant Attorney General here because he laid out all of the many matters that were advanced by the defense. And, Judge, that's why I do not think that we're at a stage where we can say there's no reasonable probability of a different outcome. I think we're in danger of becoming super jurors. There were attacks that were made against the state's case, and reasonable doubt was raised.
For this witness, though, Mr. Hunt, wasn't this just additional basis to impeach him? And doesn't the case law talk about impeachment evidence when it's merely cumulative and it has no reasonable probability of affecting the result of a trial? It doesn't violate Brady, despite the fact that it should have been turned over, that it was information that was favorable to the accused, but that last piece of it, this is just additional impeachment, isn't it?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and I think that the Court of Appeals helped me on this, and the Assistant Attorney General made this argument too. Clark's, quote, Clark's pending charges were favorable to Wierski because they tended to impeach Clark's ostensible concern for child sex abuse as his reason for testifying at trial. It wasn't just simply a credibility attack. As the court is aware, the jury heard about the 20 convictions from that Clark had. This had a different flavor. This was not the same type of impeachment. Yes, it was impeachment for bias, but this character, Mr. Clark, when he said it's the self-righteous, it's about the kids, and it turns out, and he says, that's about says it all, doesn't it? And then it turns out he's got solicitation of child for prostitution, sexual intercourse with child, drug distribution with minors, non-narcotics number three. I mean, sheesh. I mean, this is somebody who needed to be impeached. Now, there's a lot of talk out there about the danger and the damage of jailhouse snitches in cases. This case illustrates the danger. And if you're not properly armed, and the prosecution is obligated to give you the arm, one thing we've got to agree on, the defense attorney didn't have the criminal complaint. He didn't have access to that. The prosecutor had it, and the prosecutor admitted he had it.
Did the prosecutor have the police statements that would normally attend this kind of the police records, rather, and reports that would normally attend this kind of an investigation and charge?
I'm convinced he has access to it.
Does the prosecutor have the witness statements?
He didn't say so, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. He didn't say that he had police reports. In all fairness, all he said was that he had the criminal complaint. But imagine this, if you will. You're provided with a criminal complaint about all these sundry sins of a child sex nature committed by Clark testifying to a confession in a child sex offense prosecution of Wierski. So you have all these things. Any good defense attorney is immediately going to say, well, I want the police reports. I want to explore what leads there are out there. I want to see what witnesses I can talk to.
Sure. That's not remarkable. My question goes to what I think is the law developing issue, and that is whether CCAP access gives the defense, let me phrase it a different way, whether the state has an obligation, if any of that information is exculpatory, to turn it over to the defense, even though the defense arguably can find out that a charge exists of this nature on CCAP.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the state has that obligation. CCAP is not enough. They have that obligation to turn over the police reports.
Could I clarify two things, please? One, you are indeed conceding that this was available on CCAP at the time of the trial for your client?
I'm assuming, Judge. Because I didn't look for it at CCAP at that time, but I'm assuming it was out there.
Is that CCAP record somewhere in the file? Because I might be able to look at it and know that.
I'm assuming it was out there. If he was charged, I don't know what the mechanism is. He was charged 1 month before Clark was charged 1 month before Wierski's trial. Wierski's trial happened in October. Clark was charged in September.
And the charges were in Chippewa County?
They were in Chippewa County.
But the trial for your client was in Dunn, Barron?
I believe it was Dunn.
Okay. And so it was a different county, but the state indeed conceded that it was aware of the pending charges?
Yes.
Did that happen? Where is that in the record? And my first question, is the CCAP record in the record somewhere that you know?
The CCAP record may be in the record, Judge. I know I admitted a number of documents.
I can look if you just don't know.
But,
I don't really. And the state's concession that it was aware of the pending charges before calling
to
testify?
They conceded at the post-conviction motion hearing. They conceded in their brief. In support of their request that the post-conviction motion be denied. And that's why I'm able to say to you that they knew about it. And I cite to where they make those concessions, I believe, in my briefs.
Okay, so even assuming that you were able to ask the question or counsel was able to ask the question and sufficiently impeach Clark, does this then turn to a sufficiency of the evidence issue?
just want to make sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Assume the jury believed that Clark was a liar. That's your goal here, right? This one piece of evidence would have caused them to believe this confession didn't occur. You disregard Clark's testimony, right?
Right.
So without the confession, without the statement to Clark, the jury believes that Clark is lying, that this defendant did not admit it to Clark. That's what you're saying was missing here. What else was there that would support the conviction? Or how should we look at that?
I think the inability to cross-examine him show what a hypocrite he was.
No. Assume that the jury absolutely believed Clark was a liar. They still could convict your client. There was a lot there still, which is sort of what I think the Chief Justice was referring to. How do we take a look at that, or do we just say, because the state didn't turn this over, in and of itself, you get a new trial? Is there any further step we should take?
Well, Judge, it's to concentrate on what is really meant by when there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. And Strickland says it best, the standard does not require the petitioner to convince the court that the attorney's ineffectiveness more likely than not altered the outcome of the trial. In a case I cited in the brief, there's some wonderful language that makes practical what Strickland was trying to say. United States versus Liebich, 374 F3rd 219, 246, 2003. And I quote, even if the odds that the defendant would have been acquitted had he received effective representation appear to be less than 50%, prejudice has been established so long as the chances of acquittal are better than negligible. I believe, given the evidence here, the chances for Mr. Wierski to be acquitted are much better than negligible.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before you begin with the state's argument, I want to let counsel know and everyone here in the chambers know this is the first Wednesday of the month, and our Capitol has a fire alarm that will go off at 11 o'clock. It's loud. We'll all be thinking about arguments and always makes me jump. You don't have to leave, but it's really noisy. It's fair to plug your ears. So just fair warning, it's about 10:15. Likely it'll be during your argument or maybe during your rebuttal, depending. But just so you know, it's just a drill. So please begin.
May it please the court. My name is Donald Ladaraca. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. This case is an interesting case for a number of reasons. It first of all brings together some concepts that deal with how does a court assess prejudice within the Strickland context and materiality within the Brady context. And I think when the court looks at the two standards, looks at the history of how those standards develop, they really flow for stem from the same tree. So I want the court to be aware of that, and I'll address that later. This case is also important because this court has not really addressed the issue of what does it mean to suppress evidence within the Brady context in a long time. And it hasn't done so in an era where we have digital information that is readily available. Now, I think there were a few questions Justice Ziegler asked, what is the information that this was in CCAP? And the circuit court made a finding, it's record item 123, when it issued its decision on the post-conviction motion. Judge Boyle found, I'm finding that the state did have in its possession the criminal complaint that had been filed, and that was secured through a CCAP search, a normal public record search, not through NCIC. And I think that's an important observation by Judge Boyle. That is that there are some types of data that do remain within the possession of the state that a defense attorney or his investigator would not have access to.
I'm trying to remember when we started doing CCAP. I know in the county where I was, Washington County, we were one of the first counties to do in-court processing so that when a complaint was filed, it was put in immediately, that sort of thing. But that would have been after I started, which was in 97, and Randall was decided in 95. Do you know the history of CCAP and when CCAP was out there versus in Randall, was the information available by NCIC only? That's a distinction that's worth a difference, perhaps, given the exclusive possession issue.
And I think Randall actually has a different history from our standard Brady-Giglio cases. Randall, I believe the issue was actually raised on a Sixth Amendment claim. That is, the claim was my ability to impeach the state's witness was impaired, and therefore I was deprived of my opportunity to fully explore certain issues during the trial and undermine the right to a fair trial. This is a due process claim. So, and perhaps I will accept some responsibility in the Court of Appeals for not, this was a six or seven issue case in the Court of Appeals, for not making it clear there that Randall was actually decided on Sixth Amendment grounds. But I think that the Court of Appeals didn't change the Randall standard, the insurmountable burden language. I think that can be a useful construct in deciding did the state have exclusive possession. And in Randall, I think that the Court of Appeals said was we can't expect attorneys to go from courthouse to courthouse to courthouse to find things. And that certainly was in an era when CCAP at best was in its embryonic form or was just developing, that while there were courthouse terminals in individual courthouses where you could find cases that were filed within that county circuit court, you might not be able to, it wouldn't connect or link you to other counties. This is different.
Do you think that the court should clarify Randall at all, since technology has advanced quite a bit since 1995, just to make it clear that a CCAP search is probably not an intolerable burden and it doesn't involve the combing through of the records that Randall talks about, going from county to search for records?
It would be helpful to clarify that language. And I think that's where this court historically used the language, is the evidence or information within the state's exclusive possession. That language comes from cases that goes back to the early 1970s. The exclusive possession language, and I was curious, actually came from a concurring opinion from Justice Portis in a 1969 or 68 decision called Giles. And then it gets picked up in a decision by this court in Clark. And then it gets carried through in Amundson and so many other cases from the 1970s in terms of what exclusive possession means.
Mr. Baraka,
question about what is actually on CCAP. Today, if I look at CCAP in my chambers, I can see things you can't see. And what I'm wondering is, could opposing counsel actually see the complaint on CCAP or just a notification that a charge had been filed?
I think to clarify the judge's finding, I think there's some other information in the record, either in the state's trial court pleading or somewhere else, where the prosecutor said on the record, as a result of the CCAP search, I obtained a copy of the complaint. So in other words, it's not a case where, for example, in some counties, everything where I could represent to this court that complaint would have been available to anybody. I don't believe it was. From what I gather from the record, it appears that the prosecutor had to go and obtain a copy for himself.
But he knew there was a complaint to go find by the charge that was on CCAP. It was not the complaint itself that was available then to opposing counsel on CCAP, right?
That's correct.
The CCAP record indicated the charges?
The CCAP record indicated the charges. It indicated that the charges, I think, as Mr. Hutt represented, were filed in September, approximately 1 month before trial. The CCAP record reflected that that there was an arrest approximately a week later on the warrant. This isn't a case where, for example, that rare situation, and it's exceedingly rare, where a complaint might be filed under seal.
Mr. LaRocca, isn't it true that the complaint could have been filed the day before? I mean, at what point are you advocating that the duty to search CCAP becomes the burden of the defense as opposed to the state, who had the information readily available in this case?
Was it a day or a month?
This was a month, but I'm saying what's the difference? A day, a month, a week? At what point are we saying that the defense now has the burden to search CCAP to make sure that they had the ability to do that, certainly, but is it their burden or is it still the burden of the state who brings the charges?
In the case, and I want to distinguish between a case like this where it was a different prosecution unit in a different county, and this was a case that was initiated in Dunn County. There was a special prosecutor from Eau Claire County. There was a detective from Eau Claire County who did a lot of the investigation. The conduct involving Mr. Clark occurred in Chippewa County. The defense was certainly on notice that Mr. Clark got in trouble in Chippewa County because he was there on a probation hold a year earlier when he made the statement to the detective. The statement to the detective was disclosed to Mr. Wierski in advance of trial. There's evidence in the record that trial counsel had an investigator assisting him in part to flush out the information from some of these witnesses. It's not the case where we have a situation where, for example, it would be more problematic, I think, for the state if the same prosecutor or the same prosecutor's office was dealing with Mr. Clark's case at the same time it was prosecuting Mr. Wierski. But it's not this case. The counsel made the argument that he made the suggestion that, that would invite gamesmanship by prosecutors. They could sit on charges and wait to do something. And certainly when one looks at the Giglio case, where the co-conspirator is the only witness who testifies, is basically told he's not going to get prosecuted at all, and that's not disclosed. Well, that's problematic.
Well, but here the prosecutor had the information. We're not talking about a situation where they didn't have the information.
That's correct. And there's an issue of what are best practices and what's constitutionally mandated. Would it have been a better practice had the prosecutor on getting that information turned it over? But under the Brady standard, the issue is whether or not the state suppressed information that was available.
And maybe that information wouldn't have come in at the beginning because it was pending charges, but don't you agree that at the time that the defendant or the witness, Mr. Clark, made the statement about the reason he was disclosing was for the kids, at that point it might have become relevant impeachment evidence that should have been turned over?
As I acknowledge in the brief, the first question in analyzing the Brady issue is whether or not the evidence was favorable. I'm not fighting the proposition that a pending charge could go to a witness's bias. And the nature of a pending charge, as in this case, might well affect it. But we still have two more steps under the process to get through before we find that there is a Brady violation that is of such a constitutional magnitude that it requires a new trial.
But isn't the fact that the evidence was, or the charges, the information was not in the exclusive possession of the state, isn't that determinative of whether there was a Brady violation? In other words, there can't be a Brady violation unless the information was in the exclusive possession and control of the state, right?
That's correct.
So, counsel, if that's true, then how do we handle both the exclusive possession and the intolerable burden standards? How do those fit together?
Well, I think the court can look at the intolerable burden standard articulated by the Court of Appeals in Randall and say that was a Sixth Amendment case. It didn't really delve into the details, the nuts and bolts of Brady.
So can we just disregard intolerable burden when we're talking about Brady?
I think it's worth addressing, and that, and I don't want to be dismissive of that standard, because I think there may be certain cases where a court might say that's useful. But I think the Seventh Circuit standard, which the Court of Appeals looked at and which the state references, is useful in terms of what's suppression. And I think in the Seventh Circuit's context, when they're diving into suppression, they're focusing on, it's two parts. Did it disclose the information in a timely manner so that the defense could make use of it? And the second part, which I think is relevant here, and that's, it asks the question of whether the evidence was not otherwise available to a defendant through the exercise of reasonable diligence. And I think that standard, I think, dovetails with our exclusive control language. In other words, if the information could be obtained by a defendant or his attorney through the exercise of reasonable diligence, then that information was not within the state's exclusive possession.
Will you address – I'm sorry. Did you want to go?
Would you mind? Counsel, we're focusing on the CCAP entry that indicates there was a charge against Mr. Clark. Does the record reflect whether the state whether there were in existence statements by witnesses or police reports
concerning the Clark incident, or
anything that may have been exculpatory, including the Clark incident? I mean, I assume there were.
You mean with respect to Mr. Wierski's case?
Yes, oh, it, sure. This is my problem. How broad is your argument as you embrace the Court of Appeals rationale that it's the defense that now has the burden to look at CCAP? What can they find on CCAP? This was touched upon by earlier questions, but I'm a little concerned that it wasn't tied up. And so what could he have, defense attorney, obtained by looking at CCAP?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at trial counsel's testimony in the post-conviction hearing. He testified that he looks at CCAP to check the records of witnesses who might be called to testify. He made the comment that he wasn't really focused on arrest records. So there would be enough to flag and say there's a case filed in Chippewa County.
That's right.
And this is a case where defense counsel had.
But beyond that, I mean, my concern is this. Knowing that a charge is filed might get you nowhere. I mean, what you want are, go through the Brady three elements, what you want are that's information that might be exculpatory, right, that's in the possession of the state, whether it's that particular DA or available somewhere else held by the state. So I just don't know how broadly you're arguing that there is no Brady obligation to turn over anything that's exculpatory as long as they can find out that there is a charge against someone on CCAP, and then it falls to the defense to try to dig up the complaint, the police reports, the witness statements taken by the police likely. Is that what you're arguing?
If so,
it seems incredibly broad to me and a denial of due process. And so I can't imagine that you'd really be arguing that broadly.
In this case, there's no evidence that the prosecutor had the investigative file with respect to Mr. Clark, that a request was made for it or anything like that.
But he would have had access to it. I mean,
not necessarily.
There
are different district attorney's offices, and they may or may not be inclined to release that information. Now, I would submit that if that prosecutor had obtained that information, that would be something that was not available to the defense necessarily.
So your argument is only goes to the charge, and if the DA had other Brady information in the possession, that there would be an obligation still to turn that over, even though the defendant could see by CCAP there was a charge.
Correct. If there was a, but there was no one, no, at no point in the, at any time in this particular case has Mr. Wierski suggested that there was other information in police reports or other information that came out as a result of Clark's prosecution that would have added to the exculpatory nature of things. And it's, again, I recognize not everything on CCAP is available. For example, even in a prosecutor's office, not all prosecutors have access to juvenile information, or they certainly may not have access to information in other counties. And so I'm, and I know that this court has promulgated rules that have cut back a little bit on the kinds of information that will be forever out there. So I think prosecutors act at their peril if, and that's why I say this is a best practices case, in my opinion, rather than a constitutional question, when they take the risk that if they find something on CCAP that they simply assume the other side would have found it. I'm sure that in hindsight, and it might well, you know, that prosecutor after going through all of this might say, I should have just turned it over. But we're talking about, when we look at these cases, again, we have to go back to what the Brady standard is. And even if, and I want to talk briefly about materiality, because Randall used the harmless error analysis, and again, that would relate more to a Sixth Amendment claim. We're dealing with materiality. That is a, that really is like the prejudice standard in Strickland. And this court last year in the Scholler case, it was a case that was released as the parties were briefing this, went back through and discussed what that prejudice standard means. And really, both questions here ultimately, was trial counsel's performance deficient? Or did his performance, assuming there was error, prejudice Mr. Wierski? Was the state's failure to turn over that information material? Focus on the question of whether there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors or but for the fact that the evidence had not been disclosed, would the results of the proceeding have been different? And the question, when it goes back to Kyle's, the case the counsel referenced, is whether, for example, favorable evidence could reasonably be taken to put the whole case in such a different light as to undermine confidence in the verdict. And I would submit in this particular case, on this record, if the court chooses to reach the Brady issue, if the court chooses to find counsel's performance was deficient, this record, I think, when one looks at everything that went on over this 4 or 5 day trial, will find that there wasn't, that Mr. Wierski hasn't met his burden of proving prejudice. He hasn't met his burden of proving materiality under those standards. Here,
counsel, in fact, you take, as I recall, the Court of Appeals to task for not really employing the three elements of Brady in their analysis, specifically the materiality.
Yeah, I think part of that was, again, my responsibility for helping them out.
I heard you at the very beginning of your argument doing this mea culpa. That's very generous of you.
But they did identify the Brady standard. They did identify the requirements of Brady. And so, again, I think looking at this, and really when we look at harmless error and we look at prejudice or we look at materiality, you know, harmless error is only different from the standpoint that it puts the burden on the state as opposed to when we're proving materiality or proving prejudice, it's the defendant's burden.
Counsel, given that reference to harmless error, I'd like you to address, just say that the court decides opposing counsel is correct and that there was a Brady violation. Can you give us your best argument about why that should be considered harmless error?
Yes, and I think Judge Boyle did an outstanding job in issuing her decision and going through why any error was not prejudicial from a Strickland sense, and why she used the word harmless, but why the Brady violation did not rise to a level that required a new trial. She focused on the strength of the state's case. She focused on the fact that Mr. Wierski was allowed to fully present a defense, and she also focused on a third part, and that is that Mr. Clark's credibility was challenged. This is not a case, for example, where Mr. Clark was held out as an angel, but rather everyone knew Mr. Clark was in custody when he made the statement. Mr. Clark had 20 convictions, including some for felonies, that Mr. Clark Mr. Clark claimed to have had these conversations, but remember, trial counsel said, look, when I put my client on sir rebuttal, he wanted me to make the point that there were lots of people in that jail cell and that there was access to media. And that came out. In other words, you don't need to hear my client deny it again. What happened to me, Mr. Wierski, it was a matter of public record. Everybody in that jail knew about it. And I think counsel focuses on the last bit of testimony, but he ignores the role that closing arguments play. Invariably, in every trial, evidence comes in sequentially.
Yeah, counsel, before you come in, go to there. The evidence here is of a different nature than just impeachment. It's not like he was. It's not like the evidence was going to show he was convicted of an additional 5 crimes in addition to the 20 some odd that had already come into evidence. These were pending charges. And isn't it possible that a jury could look at pending charges differently from a conviction and say, you know, the reason he might be testifying the way that he is because he wants clemency on the charges that are pending against him. And so they could reasonably conclude that he has a vested interest in whether Mr. Wierski gets convicted based on his testimony. Couldn't they?
And that's a fair point. That's one reason why the state acknowledges that even if the prosecutor has not made any promises, even if a witness claims, I'm not getting anything for my testimony, there's still this idea that if I do really well as a witness, that I might get something out of it. And,
right.
And I acknowledge their case law talks about this idea that in terms of being able to probe bias, what a witness's subjective beliefs may be enough, and courts have to allow some latitude. But what I would say in looking at this case and contrast it to the Lind case, it's not a case that I cite, but it's one that I went back and looked at. Lind was a case that involved our state Supreme Court and then ended up in habeas review and bounced around between the Seventh Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court. And in Lind, ultimately the Seventh Circuit in that case said the defense should have been allowed to argue that a psychiatrist pending charges were relevant in an insanity prosecution where that state's witness was a key person. In that case, though, even the Seventh Circuit pointed out that it was the state's efforts to paint that witness with a rosy glow about a person of high moral standards and everything else, where that witness, the psychiatrist, was a key pivotal point in the state's case on proving or disproving the defense of NGI. That's not this case. No one has ever attempted to portray Mr. Clark with the rosy glow that the state attempted to portray that psychiatrist in the Lynn case.
So would this be encompassed by our line of cases that speak to the cumulativeness of impeachment evidence?
Well, I believe so. There's a case from the Court of Appeals called Rocket, which I think is a valuable or important case to consider. And it says at some point, if you've been able to impeach someone 5 ways, does a 6th way really matter that much in the grand scheme of things? In this case, I'm not saying, and I'm not discounting the insignificance of any, suggesting anything's insignificant here, but what I'm saying is that when you look at that evidence then involving Clark and go back, did Mr. Wierski have the ability to present a defense? He testified. He denied committing the assault. He had a motive. He identified the motive of these boys, and that is, theory of defense was, these boys are setting me up because they know I'm getting close to the drug dealers that they're associated with in the town of Wheeler. That's why this happened. He put in four witnesses who put in recantation-type evidence from one of the juveniles, J.P. But I think most importantly, it's to step back and look at what was the evidence in the state's case here. Two juveniles got up on the witness stand and made statements remarkably similar. The jury certainly was in a position, and the defense counsel pointed out, they could have put their stories together. But that's what trials are about. Juries get to decide, are these two people, are they so good at making up a story that they can convince a jury that Mr. Wierski is guilty? There's physical evidence that dovetails with their statements. There's the statements of their parents. Mr. Wierski's relationship with these boys was unusual. The social worker testified and said, Mr. Wierski.
All good recitation, but you've only got a couple of minutes left. I'd like you to speak to, if you would, the question of whether there was ineffective assistance in failing to ask Mr. Wierski if he'd like to rebut the testimony that he confessed to Mr. Clark.
In this case, Mr. Wierski's trial counsel testified at the post-conviction hearing that he could think of no reason why he didn't ask the question. But he later said, this is the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. And in Strickland, the Supreme Court cautioned lower courts to eliminate what's known as the distorting effect of hindsight. And I think it's also important to note the judge's findings in the trial about Mr. Wierski's testimony, which raised real questions about whether, and that was whether, and the trial court found, or post-conviction court found, that Mr. Wierski was pretty uncontrollable during his direct examination, and his cross-examination, he was worse. Never just answering questions, volunteering all kinds of information, throwing stuff out there, offering explanation after explanation. And it raises a question. Trial counsel is now placed in a position of putting a person on the stand in rebuttal and asking him questions. There's nothing in the record that says the trial counsel would have known what the answer to the question of how much conversation did Wierski and Clark have in that jail together. But what we do know is that trial counsel said, look, when I put him back on the stand, I put him up and asked him the questions he asked me to ask him. And so that's why I think when you look at this record, I don't think that that failure to ask this question in this case where Wierski's already denied it, where he's put on a strong theory of defense explaining why these boys should not be believed, why it's a setup, why he's being framed, that when you look at it as a whole, it isn't deficient not to ask that one question.
Counsel, the trial court, I want to make sure I understand, because you make reference to the trial court. The trial court, with regard to asking the question, trial court said, should he have? Probably. And so I took that to be deficient performance. And then, but then we have to come back to the overall consideration in this case. Does that or would that have resulted in something different, given the overwhelming evidence, et cetera? And so I took the trial court to say, yes, it was deficient performance, but it wasn't prejudicial for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Am I correct?
My time is up.
You can answer that question.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's a reasonable interpretation of the language, but I think her factual findings about Wierski as a witness are relevant to a determination as to whether we can say that failure to ask that question rises to the level of constitutionally deficient performance. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The prosecution had suggested that the defendant, appellant, petitioner, below did not really raise concerns about what happens after you take a look at CCAP, what's there. And I would direct the court to page 8 of my brief in the State of Wisconsin, Court of Appeals, District 3. And if I could just quote, it's a short bit, an answer to the prosecution, because it was raised, his concerns were raised. I said, the State's argument is a clever one, but it must fail because it has never been a burden on the defendant's search for whatever impeachment evidence on CCAP he may find. Such evidence is only a hint of impeachment evidence. Moreover, only the prosecution in this case had exclusive information and exclusive control as to the backstory of every charge pending against Clark that could have been used in impeachment of Clark's credibility and bias, and every police report and every videotape interview of any child Clark may have assaulted. And more importantly, Clark was never confronted with it, with, if it did exist, any confession by Clark on a recorded video or audio police interrogation. I think that ties into some of the questions that the justices have had today. CCAP's just not enough. It's what's beyond CCAP. And I think we're going to do a disservice to defendants if we place the obligation to try and find impeachment information on CCAP solely on defense counsel. You're going to see an explosion in ineffective assistance of counsel claims. You're going to also see one other problem, a grave injustice, because you can take a look at CCAP, but what are you then supposed to do? Say, oh, this is a reminder, Mr. or Ms. Prosecutor, that you didn't give me my Brady stuff? That conversation never happened 10 or 15 years ago. You got your Brady material. You got your Giglio material. You know, it's funny. I have a pending federal case, and the prosecutor there had been a state court prosecutor before he became an assistant United States prosecutor. Very good man, named William Roach.
Counsel,
he gave me a copy of CCAP,
counsel,
as part of the packet of police reports for my Giglio demand.
So aside from the fact that he had been charged with these offenses, what information would Mr. Wyarski's trial counsel have been able to use from the complaints?
Well, it would have been a different sir rebuttal. It not only would have been a sir rebuttal in which you put Mr. Wyarski on and he says, I never confessed to that man, to that jailbird.
Let's concentrate on what information you'd be able to use from the complaints.
You would call witnesses that would testify to the man's character for truthfulness. Quite possibly, you could call witnesses that would testify to the man's character for sexual impropriety.
Let me interrupt briefly because I've wanted to ask this question, and it is part of the question my colleague to my right has asked. Were there any trial court evidentiary rulings post-conviction about what the court would have done had the pending charges been raised, in terms of, even if you would have brought this up, I wouldn't have admitted it because of X, Y, and Z. Were there any of those types of rulings? Because sometimes the judge buttons that up in that, you know, it's a pending charge.
Right.
That would be a trial within a trial. I'm not going to make that record here today. We're short on time. But is there anything? I've been kind of looking through this, and that's something that's of interest. Is there any?
Judge, I think it ties into an area of agreement that we both had, that Judge Boyle made an excellent record. She went right to weighing under that reasonable probability and affecting the outcome what effect this information would have had. So I don't think there was a finding that defense counsel would have been prohibited from crossing as to this evidence. And the Court of Appeals seems to recognize it would be a
and
legitimate.
And the NCIC information that was available. Typically, when you have these motions, you go through the list, and then the court makes a finding, okay, that's going to count, that's going to count, that's not counting, this will count, that's too far. Was that done here through NCIC, and did the pending charges show up on that or the arrest?
Judge, honestly, I can't recall.
Final question. I know the red light's on, so I'll ask it briefly. But often, aside from a Brady violation, there might have been a litany of requests and a discovery request. Are there any other parts of the discovery request that you're hanging your hat on today, or are you limiting it to Brady?
Well, Judge, there was a discovery demand that was filed, and it did cite to cases like Iglio Brady, I believe. It demanded exculpatory information. It's in the record, but the defense did file a discovery demand.
Abroad, discovery demand.
Okay. Thanks. Sorry. Thank you very much. One sentence, and you can conclude your argument.
One sentence?
One sentence. Your red light was on, but I don't want you to have to sit down without having a final.
Thank you for hearing this important case. I really appreciate it. I turned 64, and I'm not going to break into will you still love me if I'm 64. But I turned 64 this year, and this is my second time appearing before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and it's been just a joyful experience and an honor, a real honor. And I appreciate you listening to my client's cause.
Very good. Thank you.
I gave you two or three sets.
There you go. Yeah. If it's praise, I'll accept it. Well, thank you very much for excellent briefs and really a very fine argument to start off our term. So we appreciate that. We are getting close to 11. The court's going to take a break so the second case can get lined up. But those of you that stay, you've got the reminder. 11 o'clock is just a drill. And we are adjourned.